Oh, hello.
It's the Real Britannia podcast, a very British podcast about very British movies with just a hint of professionalism. It's Hammer time once again, which means I'm joined by Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm joined by Mark.
Hey, hey, hey. Good morning.
How is everybody? All okay? We've just had a little chat off air, but it's been a while. Been a few weeks since we've chatted, so everybody's good, yeah?
Well, apparently, according to this film, we English never know how we feel, so...
Yeah, I don't know how I feel, yeah. Don't ask me that. I'm going to say I'm very well, thank you. That'll be it. Whatever.
Absolutely. First time watch for this one for me. I thought I'd seen it, but I hadn't. Stephen, familiar with this one until watching it this week or not?
Yeah, I think this is the third time I've seen it. I've seen it within the last year by accident on one of the TV channels, but I've seen it before then, more than probably about 10 years ago. So yes, I've seen it a couple of times.
Mark watched it recently for his own podcast, mate, didn't he?
For the first time. For the first time.
And so your second watch?
Yeah, and I was kind of watching the Runner Hammer where it was almost drawing room drama, so I really wasn't expecting much, but then I quite enjoyed it, you know, which we'll get.
Yes,
but yeah, maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago was the last time, but I rewatched it for this episode.
Okay, it's The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. We've leapt from Brides of Dracula, missing The Stranglers of Bombay and The Ugly Duckling, which were sort of filmed about the same time, because strictly speaking, they're not horror and they're not going to sort of fit in with what we're trying to do here. But it looks like 59 and 60 is the busiest period in Hammer's history, isn't it, guys? There's loads of stuff we've covered so far.
Yeah,
The Mummy,
yeah.
59, wasn't it? You know,
yeah. I will say, though, 1971 was where they put out their most horror films. They put out 7 horror films in 1971, so which is a fair few, right?
Okay, looking forward to that. We're catching up. They're into the 60s now. So Two Faces of Jekyll. We'll be back after this.
If you cannot bear to see a man change before your eyes, then shut them for just a few seconds, if you can, and listen for the shuddering sounds to end. They mark the evil transformation of Henry Jekyll to his monstrous other self, the cruel, depraved Edward Hyde.
For God's sake, man, don't kill him.
Let me alone, Jekyll. Let me alone.
Jekyll.
Is the century-old horror classic filmed as it has never been before, with a cast that takes the living shape of the characters that have enthralled billions of readers all over the world. This is Dr. Jekyll, one man with two faces and a mind split in two.
Will we ever know who we really are? Who are you, Kitty? Who are you?
Dawn Adams as his shameless wife, unaware that her husband was two men, both of them watching her jealously.
I don't deserve you, Kitty.
You don't. I deserve you. I deserve nothing better than you.
Christopher Lee as the lover who shared her deception and her danger. Here is the cold face of hate and the hot face of passion. And the face of torment.
Where is Henry?
Believe me, your husband is here.
Okay, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll was released in the UK the 7th of October 1960, directed by Terence Fisher, starring Paul Massey, Dawn Adams, Christopher Lee, David Kossoff. The synopsis: Dr. Henry Jekyll, played by Paul Massey, is tirelessly developing a personality-changing drug, despite interruptions from his friend Paul Allen, played by Christopher Lee, and his wife Kitty, Dawn Adams. Allen is dependent on Jekyll for money to pay off his recurrent gambling debts, while the seemingly frigid Kitty is adjusting to her timid husband's reclusive lifestyle. Amid mounting concern from Litauer, played by David Kossoff, a more genuine friend, Jekyll experiments on himself. He transforms into a younger, more handsome man, Edward Hyde. This is a very long synopsis, bear with me. At the glamorous Sphinx nightclub, Hyde is revealed to be a vicious, swaggering playboy. He discovers that Paul Allen has been taking advantage of more than Jekyll's generosity. He's engaged in an affair with his wife. Hyde begins a passionate affair of his own with Maria, Norman Marler, and snake dancer at the club, and forges a relationship with Allen, who shares with him the decadent pleasures of London's vice dens. Jekyll's transformations into Hyde soon slip beyond his control, and his increasingly dominant alter ego targets Allen as his first victim. I don't think we need to say any more. That's
no,
it.
No, we're going to get into this anyway.
That's the entire script.
Yes.
Well, but Mark sort of pre-warned me in a text message. He said, starts off a little bit slow, but stick with it because it's quite raw. I didn't find the beginning that slow, actually, probably because you pre-warned me, to be honest.
I always find that first 15 minutes. Just reading through it, I'm surprised this. I assumed it was based on a play because there's so much wordiness in that first 15 minutes. It feels like a play, but then it kind of lifts off and becomes cinematic. But yeah, there's a lot of preloaded expository dialogue at the beginning, I find.
Yes.
With him and his old mate, who's David Kossoff, right? Who only really appears at the beginning and the end, right?
Yeah, we don't see him throughout, do we? But I think we're getting used to that sort of preamble now, aren't we? That first 50. Apart from, what was the one that had the pre-credit sequence that...
Hound of the Baskervilles,
like action.
Where there was them chasing the maid out into the marshes.
Yeah.
Some kind of hunt. Yeah.
I think that's one of the only exceptions, isn't it? Where we go straight into the action with this like pre-credit sort of sequence that gives us a bit of the backstory. We get, as Mark said, it's all sort of preloaded at the beginning, telling us what to expect.
Dr. Jekyll is a right miserable old sod who's got a hottie wife and he really doesn't know what to do. And in your synopsis, he says she's seemingly frigid. No way!
No.
No absolutely way. Not. That is not the case. It's just he's an old fart and he doesn't know what to, I've got my work and all this. It's a dude.
There was one point because obviously as he's Dr. Jekyll, he's got this false wig, beard, some bizarre sort of makeup going on. He looked like, when the Thunderbirds puppets had beards?
I was just going to say, it is very much like it's done by a Thunderbird puppeteer.
Basically, it's kind of come straight down, which doesn't look really natural as a beard. It always looks like a stick-on beard. And that's the ones the Thunderbirds puppets had, right? So, yeah.
Absolutely. And you've got the added voice thing that's going on. His voice is lowered. But that's not him. Is that sort of electronically done, isn't it? The voice lowering.
I could believe he's an actor enough to do that himself. That's not that difficult.
I think neither of the voices were his natural voice. I think he was pitching lower and pitching higher for both.
Yeah.
And you can understand the other characters not being able to notice it's the same man because they're often people who see the same actor playing the same role and don't recognise it's the same person. That's why they didn't see through the Thunderbird puppeteer facial hair. Because it was very much, the bushy eyebrows were exceedingly pronounced.
What do we know Paul Massey from? Sapphire, isn't it? Something.
No, like Rebel.
The Rebel.
And his voice in The Rebel is the same as his voice as Hyde here. So that is his voice, I'm pretty sure. It could be someone else or it could be electronically altered, but I think he was just putting on a deep voice. Because he did swap in certain scenes. But, that doesn't mean it wasn't done using tricks. But I feel like he just swapped.
It's possibly just because he's Canadian, so...
Yeah, he is Canadian. So that gives him a weird twang. It gives him a slightly weird twang.
Christopher Lee comes in quite early into this and makes an impression right from the start. He is totally reprehensible in this. There is no redeeming qualities about this man whatsoever, is there?
Until a bit later when Jekyll kind of even discussed him, which is a bit of a surprise. He's not a good man. He's like the bad guy in Dorian Gray. I've forgotten Lord. Lord, what's it? He's that kind of character, isn't he?
It's interesting to see him so young and so happy looking throughout a lot of it. Is, you know, normally he's playing a dour, more reserved character or somebody who's playing the villain and therefore not only smiling if it's a really evil with fangs. So in this, though, it's more a dilettante, just enjoying life, and that's unusual to see him in that way. Apparently, he originally wanted to be playing Jekyll and Hyde, but they didn't give it to him.
No, I think it works. I think Paul Massey actually works better here than Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee did play Dr. Jekyll in at least one thing. And Mr. Hyde in at least one thing later on, but I think he's perfectly well cast here. Basically, I think he's doing Dr. Jekyll a favour by looking after his wife, basically, because Jekyll's not interested. So,
you mean taking care of her?
Taking care, sorting her out. All right, he's getting paid for it, but you know, man's got to work.
I don't think that's a job that you'd need to repay. He's butchering his bread on both sides, isn't he?
There was one bit that kind of troubled me in the very first scene with where he's talking to David Kossoff. Is I'm pretty sure that monkey, right? They just lit a Bunsen burner under that thing. under that cage, because it was the floor. Basically, the scene is he injects it to sort of say there's two sides to everything, and you know, and he injects it, and then the monkey starts going mental in the cage. But it honestly, I'm pretty sure they were heating up the bottom of the cage.
It didn't want to be picked up in the first place either, did it? You could see it struggling.
No.
His arms, and that's a bit troubling actually. I forgot about that bit. Christopher Lee plays a bounder and a cad very well. Yes. And I saw a still, as you look for IMDb, you know, they show stills and posters and all the sort of background of the movie. And there's one, and I'll tell you, he looks exactly like Billy Zane in Titanic.
He does,
doesn't he? Because Billy Zane
had Edwardian dress, isn't it? It's set in Victorian, but it's kind of Edwardian looking, frankly.
Yeah, I didn't notice it while watching the film, but it was this particular still where he's sitting with Paul Massey in one of the nightclubs, and he's got that grin. He's got the Billy Zane grin.
Yeah, I do love a bit of Billy Zane, by the way. He's always off the hook in all sorts of mad films.
So is this Hammer's only interpretation of Dr. Jekyll? They don't do anything else.
Well, later. Unless you include The Ugly Duckling, which is a comedy. But it's the same story, right? But
So before this, what would we have had? Lon Chaney, isn't it? I think Lon Chaney did a version. And
there was Lon Chaney and Frederick March, Spencer Tracy. I mean, they were both well considered. I think they both won Oscars for that, which is mad. I could be wrong.
The filming of the story in one version or another, you know, it does date back to like really early days of cinema. I think it's like 1908 or something, and multiple versions following then leading up to, you know, not just in the US, in I think there was one in Denmark around like 1911 or something, and etc. So there's dozens of them before we get anywhere near this, even before the war.
Boris Karloff played him in Abbott Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Because it's Robert Louis Stevenson, isn't it? It's a very, very old novel.
Yeah.
But am I right in thinking in all previous or most of the previous sort of interpretation, when Jekyll transforms into Hyde, because he's like the evil side of the character, he goes like the total opposite of what Paul Massey's, you know, sort of portraying.
Yeah, he's more apish. It's a bit like the earlier versions. Yeah, it's more. Yeah. There's something not quite right about him.
He becomes more bestial and more raw, and that's where in most other versions you have Hyde is bearded and more of a monster. Whereas it's the other way around. The Dr. Jekyll character in this one, you know, is not only bearded, but he has, you know, brown eyes and darker hair. And then when it's Mr. Hyde, he's got, you know, more blonde, not massive change, but it's more blondy, his hair, and he's got blue eyes rather than the brown. And it is the opposite way around to the interpretations, actually, from the book and from most other filmed versions, that they make the bearded and, to some extent, unfeeling one the doctor. So you're right there. They flipped it.
It's also the opposite on our bingo card, good bomb, bad brunette, isn't it? So we can't actually do that. I found a quote from Wolf Mankiewicz, who wrote the screenplay. And he explained it by saying evil is attractive to all men. He said, therefore, it's not illogical that the face of evil should be attractive. That's why I made Mr. Hyde handsome instead of repulsive. This is not a horror film. It's a comment on the two-facedness of respectable society.
Dorian Gray, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels with Dorian Gray, I think. Yeah, the charm of evil as it was phrased.
Yeah, and it works, doesn't it? Because where is this sort of stiff, sort of like man that's obsessed with his work, with his Thunderbird beard and his wig, to become an evil character? He becomes a playboy like Christopher Lee, and he goes too far, doesn't he? There's one point where Christopher Lee stops him from beating that guy with a candlestick or something, isn't
it? Oliver Reed.
Yeah.
Can you imagine this film if Oliver Reed had played the lead in this? It would be kind of amazing.
He plays
the werewolf.
But I think, imagine Oliver Reed responding as a drunk and fighting in later life. He probably would have done, yeah.
In fact, Oliver Reed is this film.
That is his life, yeah.
Yeah, so he has a drink of something, things change.
You can definitely tell that this is 1960 and not the 50s now. You know, the permissive age and all that lot is starting to kick in, because even though this got an X certificate, this is quite saucy, isn't it?
Yeah, there's lots of knickers flying up, you know, the dance, can-can dancers. There's the snake dancer woman in the bikini with all the tassels. I always like a tassel bikini.
And you suit it, man. You look really good in it as well. Let me say that. You look really good in a tassel bikini. So don't let anybody ever tell you any different.
The language as well. Doesn't Jekyll refer himself as a virgin to the society or something when he gets out the cab? She says, I've never seen.
I'm a virgin to London and London is a virgin to me.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a bit saucy.
That's what I mean. And it was that sort of language. And there's, I don't know, people are called bitches and stuff like that. And you're thinking, okay, you know.
Yeah, that made me laugh. Where one takes up, there's a pair of them, and one takes up immediately with Edward Hyde, and the other friend goes, fast little bitch.
Yeah. And then she kicks off because, yeah, that's when she calls in Oliver Reed, who must be a pimp or whatever, obviously.
And doesn't Christopher Lee at one point say, I've always done rather well with bitches?
When he's talking about his two vices, he's saying about luck is a bitch. And he says, oh, I don't know about that. I've always done quite well with bitches. Yeah.
And there's something the cab driver says when he drops him off, doesn't he, about London being bad or something. Enjoy yourself in London's fair town or something, but you have to be bad to enjoy yourself in London, I think he said.
Yeah,
it's a wicked city and it's only a bad thing if you're poor.
That's it.
Bad thing. Yeah, it's only bad if you're poor. That's quite a quote, actually.
Mm.
Which again ties in with what they were saying about the writer saying this is a comment on society rather than it being strictly interpretation, otherwise put. This is about society being, you know, you can do whatever you like and enjoy what you like, and if you're rich, and which shown in this is doing all sorts, including nearly killing a man, you know, smoking opium, carousing with the fairer sex, and etc. And yet, it you know, it's not a problem because you're rich.
I want to go to the Crypt of Fame in a second, because I want to talk about some of the background characters and some of the lesser parts, and the Crypt of Fame and the Hall of Fame are always a good way of introducing that, because there was a lot of people, because of the club scenes, there's a lot of people. So I haven't looked at the cast list, so I'm wondering if any of our, you know, usual suspects are there. But also, you know, we've got things like Francis DeWolf and all these guys that appeared in speaking roles. So Stephen, what would you like to do first? So the Crypt of Fame or the Hall of Fame?
We can do the Hall of Fame first, if you like.
Okay, mate, let's grab your keys. We'll take a walk up the path and go into the Hall of Fame first. Okay, the Real Britannia Village Hall of Fame, where anybody that's been on the show three times gets inducted. It's bursting at the seams, isn't it, mate?
It is. Yes, in fairness, it's one of the largest village halls in the entire country. it keeps getting a grant to have an extension.
Yeah, I'm assuming there's no inductees, but go through what you've got this week, mate.
Right, well, we've got seven people making their second appearance. Maria Antipas, which I'm probably not how it's pronounced. She was in From Russia With Love. Vandana Dasgupta, which is a fantastic name, was in The Rebel. Prudence Hyman was in Night to Remember.
Hyman. Her surname's Hyman.
Exactly. Yeah. Has that broken you?
Family podcast.
Anthony, I don't know what you're talking about. Anthony Pendrell was also in Night to Remember. Joe Robinson was in Carry On Regardless. Shirley Lee Scott James was in The Entertainer, and Fred Stone was in Cash on Demand.
Okay.
So we have five people making their third appearance, so therefore getting a seat.
Five inductees.
Yeah.
From this film. Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Janina Fair was in Dracula and from Room at the Top. Felix Felton, Doctor in the House, Man of the Moment. Walter Gotell from Russia With Love, Guns of Navarone. Paul Massey is making finally after The Rebel and Sapphire that we mentioned previously. And then a guy called Oliver Reed, who was in Rebel as well and had a part in Legal Gentleman.
Okay.
And then two people making their fourth appearance, which is Frank Atkinson, Oh Mr. Potter, Reach for the Sky, Young and Innocent, and Denise Shaw, Carry On Regardless, Manicucci, Death, and The Mummy. Four people making their fifth appearance. Francis DeWolf from Wish You With Love, Hounds of Baskervilles, Man of Who Could Cheat Death, and Scrooge. Helen Goss, Carry On Sergeant, Gideon's Day, Hound of the Baskervilles, Wicked Lady. Jim Morris, Man of the Moment, One Good Turn, The Rebel, and Trouble in Store. And Richard Kneller, Doctor in the House, It Chris File, Night to Remember, and One Good Turn.
Okay.
Two people making their sixth appearance.
Amazing.
Lucy Griffith, who was Carry On Constable, Carry On Nurse, Gideon's Day, One Good Turn, and Sapphire. And Arthur Lovegrove was Guinevere, Night to Remember, One Good Turn, Passport to Pimlico, and Quatermass Experiment. Two people making their seven appearances.
Now, we thought this would be not so much trouble to you, but yeah, obviously there's loads. Keep going, mate, keep going.
Jack Armstrong, Ten Willington Place, Admiral Crichton, Dunkirk, Heavens Above, Man of the Moment, Night to Remember, and Dido Plum. Ten Willington Place, From Russia With Love, Heavens Above, Ipcrest File, Melody, and The Rebel.
Dido Plum, excellent.
Dido Plum, eh? Yeah. Two people making their eighth appearance, which are names that we will recognise, because this is Jack Asher with Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, Man Who Could Cheat Death, Mummy, Reach for the Sky, and Revenge of Frankenstein, and then Terence Fisher, the director. Brides of Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, Man Who Could Cheat Death, Mummy, and Revenge of Frankenstein. Blimey. One making their ninth appearance, which is the producer, Anthony Nelson Keys, Abominable Snowman, Bride of Frankenstein, Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, Hounds of the Baskervilles, The Mummy, Reach for the Sky, and Revenge of Frankenstein. making their tenth appearance, we have one person, somebody called Christopher Lee.
Now hang on a second, this is probably one of the very few times that you're not going to mention Peter Cushing straight afterwards, because normally they go together hand in hand.
Normally they're topping and tailing, that one is getting an extra one and another one's seeing where they go on this, but no, there's no Peter Cushing in this, and maybe that would have been a choice for one of the characters in there somewhere. But yeah, so he was in Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, Hand of the Baskervilles, Lolita, Man Who Could Cheat Death, The Mummy, Pirate's Progress, Scott of the Antarctic, and Wicker Man.
Wow.
11th appearance, Michael Carrest, Abominable Snowman, Brides of Dracula, Cash on Demand, Curse of Frankenstein, Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, The Mummy, Quatermass 2, Revenge of Frankenstein, and X the Unknown.
You can't have any more. Oh, no.
Wow.
12th appearance for Patrick Halpin, and who?
Yeah, hang on. Right, who's Patrick Halpin in this? Let's have a look. Read them out while I find out who Patrick Halpin is, sir.
Right, he was Ten Willington Place, Admiral Crichton, Doctor in the House, Gideon's Day, Goldfinger, The Long Arm, Man Who Never Was, Night to Remember, One Good Turn, The Rebel, and X the Unknown. And in this, he was the officer at the Sphinx Club. Uncredited.
Okay.
Wow.
So yeah, and then one person making their 13th appearance.
No, this is ridiculous.
Ernest Blythe you know, old Ernie. 10 Millington Players, Carry On Teacher, From Russia With Love, Gideon's Day, Lavender Hill Mob, Man of the Moment, The Mummy, Night to Remember, Reach for the Sky, Revenge of Frankenstein, Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Trouble in Store.
That's 12.
No, that's 13.
13, so he's near the top.
So he is near the top, yeah. He's in the top 10, I believe, of appearances on Real Britannia.
Wow.
But still not the top, because there's two people at 16, another one at 14 maybe. So he's not in the top five, I don't even think, but still.
Wow. Now, you mentioned Lucy Griffiths.
Yes.
Lucy Griffiths was, you know, the group of gypsies, shall we say, for want of a better word, that are trying to sleep.
The singing gypsy.
The ones that are trying to con.
Yeah.
At the table. She was the one on the right hand side, and I recognised her instantly from a Carry On film, and I think it's the one with Jim Dale in the hospital where all the electricity goes because the guy that's doing the floor polishing suddenly like falls to the floor and whizzes along the floor under the beds with the floor polisher. And Lucy Griffiths is sitting in bed with those very old fashioned sort of 50s headphones on, and they spark and like big puff of smoke comes out of them. It's her.
Yeah. I remember that.
Remember that? She's in a few Carry On movies as well as a few Hammers as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Speaking of people who've been in Hammer films.
Let's go to the crypt. Lead us through, sir, to the crypt.
Right. There are three people making their second appearance, which is Janina Fair, who was in Dracula, Francis DeWolfe, Man Who Could Cheat Death, and Patrick Halpin, X the Unknown.
I thought Francis DeWolfe was in...
Wasn't he in Hound of the Baskervilles?
Hound of the Baskervilles,
Definitely two in a row for him.
Yes, he was in Hound of the Baskervilles, yes. So he's actually making his third appearance.
Brilliant. And Janina Fay is the little girl from who can't talk, the one he keeps talking about, dumb animals, doesn't he?
Also making second appearance was Patrick Halpin, despite all of his many appearances. This is only the second.
Only second Hammer. Okay.
So yes, Francis DeWolfe, I'm rightly corrected that he was making his debut in the Crypt of Fame, having three appearances. So is Ernest Blythe, because he was in The Mummy and Revenge of Frankenstein. And Dennis Shaw, old Dennis, Man Who Could Cheat Death and The Mummy.
Sorry. Dennis Shaw is the name of the highwayman in the Monty Python sketch that collects the lupins. Dennis Shaw riding through this. Sorry, brief distraction there.
Tangent, yes. And one person making their sixth appearance for the Crypt is Christopher Lee. So I don't need to name. We obviously know all the films he was in.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh appearance, just for one person, that's Jack Asher. Again, we named all of his. Two people, eighth appearance for Hammer Films, and that's Terence Fisher and Anthony Nelson Keyes. And one person, 10 appearances or involvements for Hammer Films, and that's Michael Carreras.
No Mr. Bernard this time round,
right? No, there isn't, no.
It's quite a good score as well.
Yeah. Well, it started off the beginning. Immediately, I'm thinking it's not our dear friend Mr. Bernard, because it started off like a bit of an overture.
Yeah, it was fairly nice.
Rather than that, you know, that dun 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 that we normally get at the beginning of a Hammer film, we got this sort of sweeping orchestral thing, and I thought, that's definitely not him, you know. And true to form, it wasn't, you know.
Yeah, weirdly, Monty Norman's one of the credited people for the music, which is a surprise.
Yeah, I saw that. I think, isn't this the movie? Because at the beginning of the copy I watched, distributed by Columbia came up, whereas before, was it Universal? I think they did a deal with. For some of the distribution.
Yeah, Universal,
And I think I read somewhere this marked the end of exclusive films doing their distribution, because they now had this joint thing with Universal and Columbia. So I'm wondering if we're going to see sort of like a change in sort of like cast and crew now as Columbia are brought on board. I don't know if that's going to make any difference to what we're going to get going forward. But there was certainly noticeable that it wasn't George Bernard doing the music this time.
Yeah. It was. I quite like the music. It fitted with the sort of the feel of the film, you know, and the era and stuff like that. It kind of worked quite well. Yeah.
There's a lot of things in the club, you know.
Yeah. A lot of dancing girls and everyone jollying it up and all sorts, while people were falling through the roof.
It was like the pub I used to manage a few years ago, exactly like it.
Which is odd, because it wasn't like that when you started managing it. But
no,
it was by the end.
Respectable joint, mate. Yes, absolutely.
But yes, cast-wise, there's a bit interesting just throwing, while we're talking about the cast, is two alternatives for the lead role before Paul Massey. One was Laurence Harvey, who...
that would have worked, yeah.
Was advised against it for the sake of his career by his agent.
He'd just made Espresso Bongo the year before.
You can see the link,
and that was Val Guest as well. Yeah. So not long after this, he goes to Hollywood, doesn't he? Because I think he's in The Alamo in 1960 with John Wayne. So, probably.
I remember that.
Oh, I just feed them to him, didn't I? Yeah, so I'm sure 1960 was The Alamo, so it was the start of his Hollywood career.
Yeah.
So he probably made the right decision,
Possibly, yeah. And the other one was the French actor, Louis Jordan.
Who had made Gigi the year before.
I don't know.
He made a great Bond villain, you know, he could have done it.
Yeah, he was a good Dracula. He was a great Dracula later on as well. Yeah, but I'm not sure. I like Paul Massey in this. Mm. I think it's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And we mentioned off-air about David Kossoff. And sort of desperately trying to remember what we'd seen him, and we realised it was The Mouse on the Moon and The Mouse That Roared. And you were mentioning, Mark, weren't you, something about, you remember him doing this religious TV programme.
I remember him involved in religious stuff. I think I remember him in primary school. There were books by David Kossoff retelling Bible stories. So the name David Kossoff to me is kind of relates to Bible stories. It's a bit like Thor I Heard Now, right?
Yeah.
You just think of religion and Christianity when... But interestingly, he was a Jew, but I think he must have converted, because they were, it was that Old Testament and New Testament stuff, I'm sure it was.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, so we've got the Crypt of Fame, we've got the Hall of Fame. It's only fitting that we do our version of bingo. You're sniggering already. I don't know why, because we love this part. It's Bob's Full House of Horror.
Put my glasses on.
Are you ready? Okay, chat.
I need to get my little marker pen out and everything.
Your dibber. Your dobber, aren't they?
Your dobber.
Dibblers are something else, I think.
At close of play, after The Brides of Dracula, there was a complete change in fortunes as I leapt into the lead with 39 points. Mark and Stephen joint second on 37. So that means they get the bonus card this week. Mm-hmm. And looking at this, Mark's card one, I'm two, Stephen's three.
I'm three, I think, aren't I?
Sorry, Mark's three, I'm one, Stephen's two. Yep, sorry. I'm taking card one, so I shall go first, chaps.
Yeah, go on then.
Bonus cards as well. Card one, Pitchfork Villager.
Not
in London town at this particular period in history. Michael Ripper, unfortunately not. It's a mad scientist. Come on.
Yes, that's a chew in there, isn't it? Yeah.
Not sure about Spooky Glow. Don't think so.
Nah, don't recall any Spooky Glows.
No. Or Blood Red Eyes. I don't think we had any.
Nah, there was none of that.
We mentioned this earlier. Good Blonde, Bad Brunette. It's a reversal in this case.
It is a bad brunette. A bad blonde, I mean. Bad blonde. Yeah. There's no good blondes in this. No.
And Bad Brunette, obviously the wife. You know, she was not very...
Well, she was a redhead. Bad Brunette could have been the snake dancer, but she wasn't that bad. No, she just charged heavily, you know.
Like an angry bull.
That's the point as well. Talking about permissive society and all that lot, the bit where she puts the snake's head in her mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was all touchy.
And it cuts to Dr. Jekyll, and his eyebrows just raise, you know. He's like, oh, hello.
Yeah.
Anyway.
She's talented.
Himbo. I don't think we can count the
Well,
himbo.
I guess Dr. Jekyll's the himbo. Oh, he's not Oliver Reed. Though, is he?
Oliver Reed? I don't think there is one. I'm not going to push for that.
Okay.
And Barbara Shelley, obviously, that is a rarity. We've decided that Barbara Shelley will probably be worth extra points as and when she turns up. So
is
there only one point there, Stephen?
One point, yes.
Oh, my life. Okay.
For the mad scientist. Yeah.
Card number two. Now, how are we going to do this? Should we do your cards and then we do both? No, let's do them both together. We'll do your card and your bonus, Stephen. So yeah, card number two and the bonus card, mate.
Right. So, spooky coachman. No, he was lascivious and suggestive, but not spooky. And the two things, that's anonymous. Barbara Shelley, as we've said, no, sadly not. Mystery monster. It wasn't really a mystery. You could tell who he was.
yeah, except his wife couldn't.
And his wife couldn't, his best friend and his other friend, and you know,
Clark Kent syndrome, wasn't it? Yeah,
unfortunately that was a no. There was no bats and not really any string, so there's no bats on a string.
Just a monkey on a Bunsen burner, that was it, really.
Oh, that album. We did say that bats on strings was going to be a general, like, bad special effects thing. Was there anything that was dodgy?
No, apart from the beard. No, not really.
No, sadly not. Oh, no, there was one bad special effect. When she leapt through the skylight.
Oh, yeah, that was bad. That was bad.
That floppy doll hitting the floor.
Should we go with that then?
Because I think
on strings encapsulates generally sort of bad special effects.
Yeah, we did say that before. Yeah, that special effect was... I actually wound that back to watch it again. the floppiness of that doll. Hilariously, I think it was made out of jelly. So I'll happily claim one for that then, because I think that's probably the only one I'm going to get, because there was no James Bernard score, no himbo, not any kind of crucifix, really, never mind an inventive one, and Transformed Terror.
Yes.
Yeah. I know it wasn't much of a transformation, but it was that's the whole story,
just,
right?
Yeah, it's just the facial hair coming and going.
And the eyes.
And the eyes.
And the voice. And the voice.
Well, yeah.
Only became much more fun, right? It became way more fun than he was.
Yeah. That's a terror, isn't it? Becoming more fun. Yeah. So
we've all been there.
So what are we doing? Are we gonna do Mark now and then we'll do the bonus card for both of us together, or are we gonna
do it now so we get your grand total, mate?
Right, okay then. Right, so Kensington Gore.
Yep.
Was it?
There was blood. There was blood. Surely there was blood in this somewhere, wasn't there?
When he cut his hand.
There was a lot of strangulation, wasn't there?
He cut his hand and wrapped it in the handkerchief.
Yeah. Oh, it's a push, but
yeah. Go for it. We'll allow it. It's the bonus card.
Does it include him getting beaten outside the pub as well by the scammers?
I can't remember.
No, there was no blood then. There was no blood then. No.
Definitely when he wrapped his hand, because his wife notices it and she mentions it while she's sitting in the bed.
Does he make the child bleed when he pushes it over?
No.
He should have done. Right, well, I'll happily take that, and I'm sure Mark will as well.
Yeah, good points are there.
Yeah. A jaunty hat.
Plenty of jaunty hats.
The girls in the bar, in the clubs, they all done jaunty hats.
Christopher Lee did at some point, I think.
There was plenty of jaunty hats.
The girls in the bar, definitely, yeah. So, fangs? No.
No.
No. Thanks for that.
Fangs ain't what they used to be.
They aren't, are they? No.
Worse.
Harold Goodwin, not in. A Breathing Corpse.
No.
I can't remember if the dead snake dancer was breathing or not. I can't remember.
I don't think it was obvious. I think this is more where it's very obvious.
We're going breathing or flickering.
Flickering,
And there wasn't anything obvious in that sense. Hammer Glamour.
Definitely.
For sure. There's more in this than any we've seen so far. Yeah. Except maybe the brides, you know. But plenty in this.
Yeah.
A skeleton or a skull?
I'm trying to picture the laboratory and I don't remember seeing
it. There probably was one, but I can't remember one. So, no.
No. So, I mean, I think there might have been a skull in the dancer's boudoir where she kept the skull, but I don't think we won't include that one. And then finally, yes, bar, pub or inn, we do have.
Oh, yeah, plenty of that. All of those. Yeah. All three, yeah.
There you go. So that's six in total.
Six in total over the two cards. Okay. Yeah. So,
which is mostly to do with the bonus card. So that'll be
It was five on the bonus and one on yours, wasn't it? Or am I dreaming?
This is how it works. This is how it goes. Okay, so Mark, you've got card Three.
Right. Plunging cleavage. Yes.
Hell yes.
Do I get a point for every plunging? Nah, that can't be right.
You'd streak ahead, my friend.
That's the only thing that you streak.
deformed assistant. Nah, there wasn't none of that.
No.
No Ripper.
Nope.
No Thunder and Lightning. No Spooky Glow. No Good Blonde. Mystery Monster. Did we allow that? I can't remember.
No, we allowed Transformed Terror, but we didn't allow Mystery Monster.
Okay, and no James. Nothing. Oh, apart from the cleavage. Cleavage comes up trumps for me.
So you get a point there for your standard card. What about your
four,
bonus?
Then four five. From the bonus.
So oh, four six, was it?
Four on the bonus, yeah.
That's five, yeah?
They had two from mine. It was the Button of String special effect.
You're back in the lead.
Stephen scored six, he's on 43. Mark scored five, he's on 42, and I scored a pitiful one, which put me on 40. So I get the bonus card.
You get the bonus card.
Next week, Stephen card one, Mark two, and I'll be on three. Mentioning the snake very briefly there. Was I right in seeing that she put it in a cage that had bars that were literally about 6 inches apart?
Yeah. Also, it's kind of funny that a python kills Christopher Lee because it's like, who dies from a python unless you're asleep or somehow incapacitated? I mean, you just literally walk to the other side of the room, and when it comes out, you walk back. You know, I guess pythons were more exotic back then, and people didn't know that you just don't die from being in a room with a python.
Well, there is a more recent years, the scientific discovery that they don't actually kill by crushing, they kill by inducing a heart attack. So at some point he would get tired and have to rest, and that's when it would strike, causing his heart attack. But then, you know, as a character, he's not really shown he's got a lot of heart in the first place.
The whole, I mean, unless he was terrified of snakes.
He did look that. For all I'm saying about, you know, eventually exhaustion, he wouldn't have got exhausted by the time that, you know, she'd come to the room a couple of hours later. It wasn't like it was a week later. He was, you know, got tired of pacing around the room away from the snake.
I also didn't quite understand why the wife kind of fell through the window, because she could have just not fallen for an
hour. She committed suicide. That's what it was.
Because
there was something to do with a note that was written. I'm trying to remember what the note said. That was basically, you know, that can't live. I think it was implying that Christopher Lee had committed suicide. And therefore, then she committed her suicide and it was a kind of Romeo and Juliet type thing.
I have to say, I really enjoyed this film, but I didn't understand the plot in terms of, I'll take your mark. What was he at? He was just trying to debase them, right? That was the whole thing, both of them, as his revenge, trying to bring them low in some way.
Not just them, but also his alter ego. He was trying, he confessed in the mirror to trying to destroy, which was, you know, destroying himself, and then ultimately by the police catching him rather than getting away with it, it ended up being that plan by Hyde had been scuppered. But it didn't turn out well for anybody, I would say.
I'm just glad that old Dame Rejeko had a bit of fun at the end of his miserable life, frankly.
Well, they changed the ending, because the original ending, and I think this was either budgetary constraints or time constraints, he was going to go to the gallows, and as he dies on the gallows, he transforms into Dr. Jekyll, but they had to cut it at the last minute and change the ending. I also just read somewhere as well that this association with Columbia and the whole fruitiness, shall we say, of the script didn't go down too well. So Columbia never put it forward for approval by the Hays Code, or the equivalent to the Hays Code. And in the end, they released it as an 80-minute cut version.
Right.
And it was called Jekyll's Inferno at the time.
Okay.
There was another version released by AIP called House of Fright, but that didn't get released till 61. So it had a lot of issues getting a sort of worldwide release.
Yeah, well, it was a bit fruity, like you say, certainly for 60. And I'm glad we didn't see the cut version, because I imagine that wasn't much fun. This was pretty fun.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, when we sort of look back and say 59 and 60, as we said, we've got some crackers coming out. We had the Mummy, and we spoke about the other ones in between, like Terror of the Tongs or whatever it was, or The Stranglers of Bombay, I think it was, in between. But then we're going to get Curse of the Werewolf and all of this sort of stuff, and we just had Brides of Dracula. So they're getting sort of like a very mismatched return on the movies. Some are hitting the heights and some are just failing miserably.
Yeah, and I have to say, there are a few films after this where they're obviously pulling back and making it much more sedate. So it might be this was the overstretched and made them think maybe we need to retool back down to what's it, but then they realize nah, they gotta go back to what they're, you know, what people want to see, really, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, they're running out of ideas with regard to remaking the classics from Universal and those sort of early movies. You know, we've just got the Wolfman to come up, that really is the last of them.
I think Phantom of the Opera comes up too.
And Phantom of the Opera, of course, that's going to be the last of them as well. So
yeah,
we've still got a good run. And as you said, Mark, you know, we get a great run in the early 70s, but I like some of the mid-60s stuff that's coming up as well.
Oh, there's always gems. There's always gems in the camera, you know?
Yeah. Does anybody want to add anything? Because a first time watch for me, and I absolutely loved it. It was it had Hammer written all over it, but at the same time, it was just that little bit different because you didn't have the James Bernard score or Peter Cushing, who we've seen in every movie for the last four or five movies, you know. And Paul Massey was excellent in it. The supporting cast was great in it.
I've got a few things to say about Paul Massey in this. I thought it was really good. He reminded me, it was kind of almost like a Joker character, right? It was kind of off the chain in quite a lot of this and did not care. And it reminded me a bit of, there was an earlier film, famous film from the 40s called Kiss of Death, where Richard Widmark plays this psychotic character who pushes an old lady in a wheelchair down a staircase. It's famous for that. And his... how Paul Massey was doing this kind of reminded me of that guy. And interestingly, this is kind of tidying up way too much. Frank Gorshin as the Riddler in the Batman series kind of based his performance on Richard Widmark's performance.
Yes.
And Paul Massey in this kind of reminded me of the Riddler in Batman 2. So
the grin.
It was the grin, the toothy grin. If you go really back, Conrad Veidt in The Man Who Laughs, I think it is.
Yeah.
That was... was that the Riddler or the Joker?
The Joker
was based on that.
Yeah.
And apparently, tying it up again, Richard Widmark really liked the Batman comics and based his performance on the Joker, so which is really weird. And I'm kind of tying Paul Massey into all of this. But yeah, he reminded me of the Joker.
Frank Gorshin, in his stand-up routine, used to do these impressions, didn't he? And I think Richard Widmark was one of them.
Yes.
As well as sort of Burt Lancaster and all those guys. He does these amazing impressions.
Frank Gorshin is amazing. Yeah. I honestly think if you had to pick one character from that old 60s camp series that actually would work as a serious, horrible character in a more heavy Batman, Frank Gorshin as the Riddler would be the one. Not with the green outfit, obviously, but as the character. But yeah, no. Paul Massey, I thought, was really good in this, really delivered. It's interesting how bad the reviews are of this film.
They don't
jive with what we saw for me at all.
It said it performed disappointingly in box offices around the world. Hammer's returns fell significantly short of its production outlay in the months following its release. While there's much to enjoy in this uncommonly sophisticated Hammer horror, its rich performances fail to surmount an inadequately conveyed central conceit, whatever that means.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
There's a good film there that people didn't see, basically. That's
I have to say also the costume design was pretty great. You know, the some of the women outfits were, and I don't mean like the tassel bikinis, I mean the woman that was who said, you know, fast little bitch, had this wonderful tartan dress on, for example, like well, it wasn't a dress, but top and skirt. It was like real. Hammer's always like this with attention to detail and costumes, aren't they? Really?
Yeah.
It was fantastic, and the mid use of that vibrant colour. I think one of you mentioned earlier on that was very much there, bringing to life. And certainly the lab scenes were a lot more greyed out, and they used the colour to add, you know, emphasise the vibrancy of the world outside of his own insular setup. And that was, you know, I think something that would need to be recognised. But I think costumes and etc., I think they really did bring it in. Certainly the Hammer sort of quality that we look for and what we're used to seeing, despite there being a few elements like, say, Peter Cushing and Bernard not doing the score, it still is very identifiable as a Hammer film.
Yes. Well, according to the poster for Jekyll's Inferno, the American release, it says it was filmed in colour, which I think was pretty obvious, and Megascope, right, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
The German poster says it's filmed in Eastman colour, which would make sense.
It looks like Eastman to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a Blu-ray copy of it and it looked really glorious. It was a wonderful copy that I watched of it. And as you said, Stephen, you know, that whole thing of the transformation from the laboratory to the nightclub, it just heightens the whole sort of debauchery and the bawdiness of it, because he's gone from this very sort of drab, you know, where the plaster's actually coming off the walls in that laboratory, to something that's all red velvet and bright gold and dancing girls and colour. And it really just highlights the two worlds that he inhabits as the two different characters. So yeah, perfect cinematography in this.
Yeah, there's a comment in it, isn't there, about the neglect of his home, and it's not just the neglect of the walls and stuff, which right behind his head there is some brickwork showing through the plaster, but neglect of his home also in the sense of neglecting his wife. I can't remember which character says that to him while he's in the laboratory.
Should we wrap up there with this? I think we've
There was just this era decadence about that club. I think even the owner, wasn't she like a fairly masculine woman? It was kind of...
I feel like they were pushing
boundaries. She was good, but I can't remember who it was. But yeah, it was kind of interesting that they had these little touches like that that didn't need to be there, but were.
Yeah, because that would have been controversial at the in a sort of mid-Victorian, you know, 1870s, 1880s. It would have been very controversial to have a woman dressed as a man, and that shows the decadence of that night spot. I think that the host is a woman dressed in man's clothes. So you're right. That's a subtle touch that actually would have, you know, would have chimed at the time.
I thought I recognised her. I'm looking through the cast list to see who it is.
Yeah, I don't know what the character's name was.
At first, I thought it was Yvonne Mitchell, but it's definitely not Yvonne Mitchell, because she would have got a credit.
No, there's also, you know, for a very brief second, I thought, oh, is that Miriam Carlin? But it wasn't.
It did look like Miriam Carlin, yeah.
Yes, you're right.
We may never know. I'm still looking out. I can't see. It'll come to us by the time we meet again in a couple of weeks' time. Okay, let's leave that there, guys. That's the two faces of Dr. Jekyll. Let's take a brief break and we'll be back with what we're watching next time. So next time, chaps, when we're going to meet up in a few weeks' time, we're still sort of in the filming schedule for 1960, but the official release date, according to this, is the 1st of May 1961.
Right.
Oliver Reed made his Hammer debut in Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, but that was the start of quite a sort of prolific career for him with the studio, Mark, wasn't it? He does do quite a few Hammer movies in the next
A few. He does one that I'm not sure we'll include because it isn't their traditional gothic horror, but it's one, a sci-fi... what's it called? These Are the Damned or The Damned.
Yeah.
He's a head of a bike gang, which is, you know, eminently entertaining.
Paranoid, I think I remember, was one with him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when we're going to see him again, obviously, but it is start of at least four or five movies for Hammer.
Yeah.
So, also starring Clifford Evans, Yvonne Romain, Catherine Feller. It's directed by Terence Fisher. Carreras and Hines are involved. I'm not sure about the music. We'll have to have a little look when we get nearer to the time. I haven't seen this. I don't know. I mean, I watched it on the original BBC double bills, Mark, that, you know, we all watched on Saturday night. I've watched it once since. Twice.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. Stephen, you've seen this, haven't you?
I think, yeah, I've seen it at least once, but I'm not sure I've seen it any more than that, to be fair.
Well, we should be all right for bingo cards with things like, you know, pitchfork villagers and all that sort of stuff, because they certainly make an appearance in this movie. Transformed Terrors and Blood Red Eyes, I think we're going to get a few points next year.
Yeah, there's some great makeup in it, I have to say.
Yeah, looking forward to
it. Not better than Paul Massey's, surely.
No, Oliver Reed wears an all-over beard in this one. Completely head to foot. Stephen, thank you so much for the... We call them the Herculean efforts that you go
oh
to.
Oh, my goodness. I cannot believe some of this.
Yeah. Surprising us every single week. Not that many Night to Remembers this time, though. Do you notice that? There wasn't that many
Night to Remembers. No, there was only half a dozen. Yeah.
Yeah, and the usual suspects weren't there, the Harringtons and the Chamberlains. So let's see what Curse of the Werewolf throws up. Mark, thank you once again for joining us for the Hammer Shows, mate. Greatly appreciated, as always.
You're very welcome. Always enjoy a bit of Hammer.
Lovely. Right. Well, I'll see you chaps in about a month or two's time, and we'll do Curse of the Werewolf. Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Positive shot.
Bon voyage.
Goodbye. Good luck.
Thank you.
British hand up, sir.
Ha ha ha!